I'll call the House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. Excuse me. As chair, I have convened this committee for a public information session. We will not be taking any formal action today, and as such, there is no requirement for all members of the committee to be present, although all members have been notified and invited to participate. As a part-time legislature, many members attend to other duties in between formal convenings of the legislative sessions. So members not able to be present today will be formally excused. And with that, I'm going to ask the clerk to take the roll just so we all know who is in the room with us today.
Mariani.
Present.
Christensen.
Present.
Considine. Dean.
Present.
Edelson.
Present.
Howard. Howard. Johnson.
Present.
Lush. Lush. Long.
Present.
Lucero.
Yes.
Miller. Miller. Moeller.
Present.
Nash. Nash. Novotny.
Present.
O'Neill.
Present.
O'Neill, present. Pinto.
Present.
Holston. Holston. Considine. Howard. Lesh. Miller. Nash. Holston. Cool.
Very well. I trust we have a quorum nonetheless to the clerk.
Yes.
Very well. Members, again, there will be no formal actions taken today. This is an information hearing, and so all members who are not able to be present are formally excused. I know I heard from a couple of members myself directly that they had other work duties and engagements to be at today. My hope, and by the way, this for the public, this committee is being held subject to Minnesota House rules that allow for formal hearings of the House and actions to be taken without needing to be physically present through the use of internet, teleconference procedures. That rule is present on our website, Minnesota House, so if anyone wants to look at that. If there's anyone in the public that wishes to send in a comment or a question during the course of our discussion, you can do that by emailing our committee administrator, our legislative administrator, Jason Chavez at Jason, J-A-S-O-N dot Chavez, C-H-A-V-E-Z at house.mn. Members, my hope is that we'll keep this hearing relatively short. I'm shooting for about an hour. We do have, typically we can do an hour and a half in a hearing, and so a lot of that will be determined by the level of engagement discussion that we want to have. But I'm hoping that we can provide a concise information hearing today. And the purpose, let me just share very quickly. As the state legislature prepares to be reconvened in the coming weeks, we have important business to attend to, including responding to the police killing of a Minnesota citizen witnessed across our nation and worldwide that triggered massive civil unrest, mostly a peaceful exercise in our First Amendment rights to publicly protest, but also accompanied with damage to life and property. This body, the Minnesota House of Representatives, through the work of this committee, constructed and passed a comprehensive package of reforms aimed at enhancing public safety through increasing police accountability, both personal and through our government systems, governing the licensing and authority over law enforcement professionals. That was work that we concluded rapidly during the course of the most recent special session. That proposal was essentially dismissed by the other legislative body when they walked away from negotiations in adjourning the special legislative session. Today's hearing and purpose is to publicly share a nonpartisan comparison of the proposals that were forwarded to end police brutality by the House and by the Senate. I am mindful as chair of this committee that in the very brief time that we had in special session, we were not able to have a discussion across the bodies that involved the public. And so part of today's purpose is to make sure that the public is aware of the proposals. So without prejudice, the proposals that were on the table before us at the end of that special session. We are then going to move to hear from three public officials on three elements featured in the House bill. We'll hear from Chief Kelly McCarthy, who's chair of the Police Officer Standards and Training Board, our state licensing board for law enforcement. And she'll speak to the need for licensing reform for our law enforcement professionals and government entities. Next, we'll hear from our public defender for Hampton County, Mary Moriarty, who will speak to the need for an action review of our state's use of force doctrine for criminal action and accountability. And then our third public official will be St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter, who will speak to the need and desire to modernize our approach to public safety that adds new practices to the use, along with the use of licensed peace officers. We'll have some committee discussion in the form of question and answer for these presenters. And then we will close our hearing by hearing from an academic expert of civil unrest and police reform. So members, that's how I intend to proceed. And before I launch in, I just want to check to see if there are any questions from committee members. All right. So with that, I believe our nonpartisan House staff have prepped and are ready to do a simple walkthrough. We don't need to do an in-depth technical walkthrough, but a simple walkthrough comparing the Senate's proposals on this issue and the House proposals that were on the table at the end of the last special session when we were sharing our proposals with one another. And so I'd call on our House staff to walk us through that nonpartisan comparison of the provisions.
Mr. Chair, members, this is Ben Johnson. I'll do the walkthrough.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, I was provided with the final offers from both the Senate and the House and asked to walk through the provisions that were on that, giving enough detail so everyone would understand and not taking very much time. I'll attempt to meet both of those goals.
Thank you.
The Senate offer contains two provisions that had no House comparable provision. I'll start with those two. First involved law enforcement training. The Senate would have provided $6 million in fiscal year 2020, $5.4 million in fiscal year 2021, and $5.6 million a year thereafter to support law enforcement training. The second Senate only provision involves background checks for employees of law enforcement agencies. Under current law, employers must make information available as part of a background check for individuals applying to work as peace officers. The Senate provision would require disclosure of that information for all candidates for employment with law enforcement agencies. This was House File 3243, which Representative Pinto carried. Then there are a series of provisions that appear with differences in both the Senate and House provisions. The first involves peer counseling and critical incident stress management. The Senate language adds the critical incident stress management counseling and makes some changes to the existing peer counseling statute. It's substantially similar to an early version of this language that this committee heard. The House language, as you probably all remember, underwent some significant changes, included amending some of the definitions, established some specific training requirements, and lists exceptions for situations where individuals, counsel, others could disclose some or all of the information obtained in the session. Next provision involves reporting deadly force incidents to the BCA. The Senate and House language were nearly identical. The House offered to take the Senate language. Next provision involves chokeholds and neck restraints. The Senate directs the Post Board to develop a model policy and law enforcement agencies to adopt a comparable policy that prohibits officers from using either carotid control or neck restraints or chokeholds that restrict airways unless that use is on a person committing a violent act that's imminently threatening great bodily harm or death, and the officer also first considers less lethal measures. The House provision would codify the prohibition in the use of force statute and also contains a definition of chokehold. The definition comes from Colorado law and also requires law enforcement agencies to adopt a policy. The next provision involves the duty to intercede. Again, the Senate directs the Post Board to develop a model policy and law enforcement agencies to adopt a comparable policy. That policy would require peace officers to intercede when they observe another officer using force that is clearly beyond what is objective and reasonable, and also report that incident to the chief law enforcement officer. The House requires training on interceding as part of the use of force training, and also establishes that the duty to intercede is a licensing requirement, directs the creation and adoption of policies. The House has a lower standard for an officer to meet when required to intervene or intercede. Next provision involves use of force. The Senate directs the Post Board to update the model policy on use of force and law enforcement agencies to adopt a comparable update. That updated policy must include recognizing and respecting the sanctity and value of all human life, and also includes the need to treat everyone with dignity and without prejudice. The House makes changes to the section of law that authorizes the use of deadly force and requires an updated policy. Those statutory changes would limit situations where the use of deadly force would be authorized, and it would focus on situations where a person was presenting a threat of death or great bodily harm to an officer or another person. The next provision that appears in both offers involves changes to the Post Board. Currently, the Post Board has 15 members, two of whom are public members. The Senate proposal would add two additional public members to the board, and the governor would appoint those members. The House proposal would add four additional public members. Two of those new members would be appointed by the governor and two by the Commissioner of Human Rights. There are some specific requirements for each of those four individuals. The House also includes the Peace Officer Community Policing Excellence data provision in this offer, and that would require law enforcement agencies to submit data on peace officer use of force incidents, complaints filed against peace officers, and officer misconduct incidents to a research organization selected by the Department of Public Safety. The designated organization would be charged with storing, organizing, monitoring the data, and identifying peace officers that require corrective action. Next provision relates to autism training. The Senate language is essentially identical to the House language, and the House offered to take that Senate language. Next provision involves mental health training. The Senate and House provisions are substantially similar, but there are a few small differences. Both add this training to the current requirements for 16 hours of crisis response and similar training. The House would require that this training consist of a minimum of six of the 16 continuing education credits in a three-year cycle. The Senate does not specify a minimum number of hours. There's also a slight difference in the amount of money appropriated for this purpose. The next provision involves arbitration reform. The Senate would carve peace officers out of the existing grievance procedure requirements that include binding mandatory arbitration for all grievances and any written discipline or disciplinary actions, including termination. Peace officer grievances would proceed instead through a contested case hearing with an administrative law judge. The House provision would establish a new arbitrator roster appointed by the governor to hear grievance arbitrations for written discipline, discharge, and termination of peace officers that arise under collective bargaining agreements covering peace officers. The House then had a few provisions that were not contained in any Senate proposals. I'm going to walk through those briefly since we've spent a lot of time on those. The first is the warrior-style training. The House would prohibit the Post Board from certifying courses, granting continuing education credits, or reimbursing agencies for warrior-style training. The next involves peace officer residency. The House would allow cities and counties to establish residency requirements for peace officers as a condition of employment. The next involves the civil statutes of limitations. The House would eliminate the civil statutes of limitations for claims of sexual assault or wrongful death against peace officers, and it would toll some other claims while investigations into those incidents were taking place. The next provision is the Law Enforcement Oversight Council. This would require local units of government that have law enforcement agencies that employ 50 or more peace officers to establish a citizen oversight council, empower those councils to make recommendations and provide assessments on any facet of the agency's operations, conduct investigations into police misconduct allegations, and if permitted by the city, impose discipline on officers. Next provision is the independent investigatory unit in the BCA. The House would establish an independent use of force investigations unit in the BCA to investigate all officer-involved deaths and criminal sexual assault allegations made against peace officers. Next provision is the community-led public safety coordinator. The House would establish a coordinator in the Department of Public Safety to promote alternatives to traditional policing models and increase community involvement in and engagement with law enforcement agencies. It would also establish two grant programs to promote alternative responses to crisis situations and promote community healing. The final House-only position is the Officer-Involved Death Review Board. This is the provision that's labeled Officer-Involved Death Review Board in the bill. It would establish a review board in the Department of Public Safety to examine officer-involved deaths. Mr. Chair, that concludes my walkthrough here. If there are more specific questions, I'm happy to answer what I can.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Very well done. Very good, concise walkthrough.
Mr. Chair?
Again, I thought it was particularly important that we had a public airing of the issues that were before us at the end of the session as the two bodies were exchanging some ideas. So, Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, when you were talking about the change in the use of force, you left out a word that I thought was important. I know it was included in the original bill relative to an officer using deadly force or imminent deadly force or great bodily harm, and that's the issue of that it needs to be in an imminent situation and not as currently stated in 609.066. Am I understanding what's in the bill, or am I misunderstanding that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, representing, the change does include the word imminent. I was asked to not do a line-by-line change, so I tried to stay very high level.
Well, I appreciate that, but personally, I think that's a critical part of the provision, so thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. That's why we all have committee members, and we ask questions and make sure that points are emphasized in terms of our intent. Any other observations or questions of Mr. Johnson? If not, then Mr. Johnson, thank you. And I do want to express my deep appreciation for moving quickly to be able to put that together for the committee and for the public today. Your work is much appreciated here. I did fail to mention, members, that we are joined by Representative Rita Moran, who's not a member of the committee, but who chairs the BFL Posse Caucus, a group of 14 legislators of color, indigenous legislators, who played a significant role in shaping the proposal that we passed off the floor of the House, including chief authoring the individual provisions within the 1920 separate provisions that were in that body. So welcome, Chair Moran, to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Mariani.
So members, next, we're going to move to our presentations. And as I stated earlier, the focus for the purpose of this is to have three public servants share with us their knowledge and understanding of three of the major issues that were in the House bill. Not the chair's
Chair Mariani.
Hold on, Representative Johnson, I'll call you in a second. It's not my intent to walk through the entire bill in depth, but just to focus on three particular pieces. It is quite possible that we may convene again, depending on when special session is called. The other body is has expanded its series of hearings as well. And so I think as long as the public is being focused on these issues, we may also want to continue to more carefully deliberate through the provision before us of the police accountability proposals. But Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I didn't have any questions for Mr. Johnson, but I had some comments to make on the side-by-side issue. As a whole, the bill that the House brought forward had bipartisan opposition for on the House floor, while the Senate bill had bipartisan support for the provision that the Senate brought forward, which dealt mostly with the issues going on in the Minneapolis Police Department that they brought forward. We also agree the warrior-style training needs to be looked at, but we got to be careful how we define that, and it needs to be taken more like, and we talked about it in committee, dehumanizing training. I just saw I was happy to see a post on Facebook from the Law Enforcement Labor's Union of that unfortunate officer, Eric, that was shot in the face down in southern Minnesota doing the rehab. They had some video of him actually finally walking with assistance for the first time the other day. So I want to keep him in our prayers as he continues healing from being shot in the face. But a lot of these issues that we're dealing with, we had a list of, in the proposal, 11 things that the Senate and also my side of the aisle agreed to, yet we were unable to bring them forward to deal with some of the issues that are occurring in the Minneapolis Police Department. I also sent the committee administrator a news release put out by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights to be added to this agenda. I would like to make sure that is added and that it is read into the records as well. I did email that to all parties that are here today, and I hope you had a chance to read it as they are working with. And I'm hoping to get some more information from the police department on the changes that they have implemented since that unfortunate incident involving George Floyd, that we can start getting the changes needed in the Minneapolis Police Department to make them a better department. And hopefully we can continue this conversation, because those issues are pretty much centered in that department and not the rest of the state. Those issues that should have been done with internally were not done, showing the lack of leadership in that department and the lack of oversight by the city council and the mayor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Johnson. And I do believe that there's plenty of room for common agreements eventually, and hopefully sooner than later, in regards to police accountability, legislating around police accountability. I think that there are core Minnesota values around treating people with respect and valuing life that is not a partisan issue, not a geographic issue. So I'm hopeful that that'll provide plenty of room for us to move forward with a substantive action on the part of the legislature. I would add that there were several provisions in the House package, and you did properly say as a whole in the House proposal, but there were several provisions, notably in the Reclaiming Oversight Act, that actually enjoyed active recorded votes on the part of four members of the minority party in the House, both in the Government Operations Committee as well as in this committee. In terms of the Minneapolis Police Department, I think you and I probably have a lot of agreement on some things that major things that need to happen relative to that. Police Department, however, none of the proposals that have been offered by either body single out the Minneapolis Police Department. They were offered in terms of addressing the overall state of affairs of policing in our state, particularly around regulatory expectations that we would have, not just of police officers in the city of Minneapolis, but law enforcement officers around the state. And then finally, let me just say, I will read that human rights memo. I haven't seen it, so I will review that. I'll take it from there in terms of how to get posted. As you know, it's custom and usage for a chair to be able to see that information to make a decision about posting, but I will look at that objectively. And then finally, I too, and I suspect that this is true of all members of our committee, join you in your prayers for our public servant who was injured severely in the course of his duties attempting to protect the public. We need to honor all our men and women in public safety, even as we expect good, strong, high standards from them in the course of their work. So thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, members, we're going to move to
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask. I appreciate the opportunity to have this comparison. I just had a couple questions about kind of where things are at in the Senate, if I can really, really briefly, just to make sure that I'm clear about the setup here, because I know we had more than 12 hours of hearings on the proposals passed through our committee and through the House floor. My understanding is that the Senate never did have any committee hearings on their proposals, but I may be wrong about that. Could you or someone clarify that?
Chair Pinto, I actually don't know the technical answer to that. I know that there were some deliberations in the Senate. I'm fairly confident to say that the House spent an inordinate amount of time and long hours on these proposals. As you recall, we spent an entire Saturday, 7 hours, taking testimony from dozens and dozens of Minnesotans, including law enforcement individuals, as well as community-based folks and survivors, family survivors, and members who have been killed through use of deadly force at the hands of law enforcement. Including law enforcement individuals outside of the state of Minneapolis, I would add. We then had a five-hour markup period. Then we had presentations of these provisions and three other committees, and then a seven-hour floor debate final passage. So I know on the House side, a ton of time and energy. I actually do not know the length of time or how much deliberation went into the Senate proposals.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pretty certain I'm actually getting some messages from folks that the Senate did not have any committee hearings on their proposals at all. And so I think it's really good that we at least are shining a light and having a committee hearing. It's a little bit odd, unusually doing that, but it's important that somebody shine a light because that did not happen in that body. And I guess then my other question to you is just about the process. My understanding is that you, on behalf of the House, had made an offer to the Senate. There was maybe a bit of trading of offers, but that at this point, an offer was made and we've been awaiting where is the most recent offer was made by the House to the Senate. At this point, we're continuing to wait for some kind of response from the Senate to that offer. Is that correct?
Representative Pinto, that is correct.
Okay.
Instead of put a few requests on the table in the form of an offer, they were pretty adamant that we needed to take that because we were apparently running out of time and just needed to move. We quickly did a response and actually incorporated, and you heard some of that in the presentation from Mr. Johnson and the nonpartisan walkthrough. We did accept some of the language from the Senate. We actually found some of that language is pretty good, but we also did put our best ideas forward on the table. That was incredibly short, quick meeting in which the Senate then announced that we were officially out of time because they were going to go sighty-die without an agreement from the House or the governor on that. They then walked off out of the room with the offer, and we, to this day, have not heard a response back. I can tell you that I have had one, two discussions with the principals in the other body most recently, but none of those have involved a response to the offer that the House put forward.
And Chair, in the interest of time, I just want to ensure that the record was there was a single Senate hearing, both informational in nature, and the record afterwards was filed with the House floor session. There wasn't an official vote or official action taken during that hearing.
And for the record, it's our committee administrator sharing that information.
Thank you for the clarification. Thanks for the information, Mr. Chair. That's really helpful. And thanks for holding this hearing today. It seems really important to shine a light on this. Thank you.
Concur. Thank you. So with that, members, we're going to begin by hearing.
Mr. Chair.
I did hear a voice. Yes.
I apologize. Wait, a few of us have hands up, but.
Sorry, I'm not seeing that. Okay.
I'll be very brief. I know we want to get to our testifiers. I just wanted to respond briefly to Representative Johnson's comments. I share Representative Johnson's concern for oversight of the Minneapolis Police Department. I do want to point out that the Minneapolis Police Department, Minneapolis City Council and Mayor have made several changes that both the House and Senate have been requesting, including upgrading their use of force policies to focus on sanctity of life. They were the first city in the country to ban warrior training. They've been using data as an early warning system for police officers, but these reforms have been insufficient. And many of the reforms that the city of Minneapolis has sought to do have been blocked by the state legislature, including the residency requirements that we are seeking here, and an ability to have real civilian oversight. So I think one of the purposes that we're trying to achieve is to allow the city to have more tools to move forward on accountability for the Minneapolis Police Department. But we also can't pretend that this is a Minneapolis-only problem. And it's very convenient, I think, to just point the finger at one department and say it's only one department's issue. But when the working group that was led by Commissioner Harrington and Attorney General Ellison traveled the state, they said that they heard from communities in every corner of the state that were concerned about the policing behavior in their communities. And so this is not a problem that's limited to one city. We also know that 60% of the use of the deadly police-involved deaths in the state occur outside of the metro area. So this is not a problem that's limited to one city. It's not a problem that's limited even to the metro. And we really do need to take a holistic look at how we're doing public safety across the entire state. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence.
Thank you, Representative Long. As I indicated earlier, we may well be having some other hearings as well. The Senate looks like they're intact on having several hearings. And so as long as we're joining properly the public's attention to this important issue, it may well be helpful to have the City of Minneapolis come in and share the steps that they've taken in the past as well as what they're currently doing. So perhaps we can work on that together. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to also point out that although the Senate gave us a list of 11 proposals, those actually came out of five different bills. And so it looks sometimes like there's a lot more there than what actually is, including the fact that several of the proposals, as nonpartisan staff Mr. Johnson pointed out, with the Senate version would just be a model policy from the post board versus actually taking action on some of the items. And I just wanted to specifically point out two of the items that are on the Senate's list were actually in one bill that I carried during the general session. One was the peer support, and then the other one was the use of force reporting. And I just wanted to point out that while the use of force reporting is certainly needed, and that's why I carried that bill, but it's already being done by, I believe, 70% of law enforcement agencies. So it's important, but it's certainly not something that's going to make a huge change. I also, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, just wanted to ask Representative Pinto a question about the bill that he carried in the regular session that wasn't included in our package, but was in the Senate package.
Representative Pinto.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so Representative Pinto, I was just curious what that bill did. I can't remember all the details of it, and if would like to know what your thoughts are and if you think that's really relevant to the discussion that we're having here.
Representative Pinto, did you have a relevant bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think, Mr. Chair, I think, Mr. Chair, what's being referenced is Mr. Johnson, in walking through the Senate proposal, had referenced a proposal to have more background checks of employees at law enforcement agencies who are not sworn officers, I believe is what's being referenced here. That is a bill that I was the House author of and certainly think it'd be a good thing to do. What the relevance is of that to the situation involving the murder of George Floyd and the disparities that we see in our criminal justice and law enforcement systems with respect to especially communities of color, I do not know. And so I'm not really sure why the Senate included that on their list. And that may be one of those proposals that perhaps pads the number up to 11, but in fact, there's a lot less there than there seems. So I appreciate them listing it, but that's not gonna do the job in my perspective.
And in full disclosure, I can let everyone know that the House counteroffer, which we have, again, not put a response yet from the Senate, did not include that provision, even as we strove to include provisions that the Senate had put on the table. Representative O'Neill. I'm sorry, Representative O'Neill, are you done? I'm sorry.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to say anything, but when Representative Long started talking about Greater Minnesota, and I believe he said the officer-involved deaths, that 60% of them are in Greater Minnesota, and I want to know where that information comes from, and I would like a copy of that, because this is what I know. Wright County is 140,000 people. We have the third largest sheriff's department in the state. And in the last 17 years, there have been 17 incidences where people have complained about excessive force, one of which was upheld, the other were unfounded. I also know that in probably about 20 years, there have been four discharge of firearms, two by citizens and two by police officers. And one citizen was hit after he actually fired at police and there was a return of fire. So I know of one officer involved shooting that resulted in death in 20 years in Wright County. So I'm having a really hard time understanding how we get to 60% of all officer involved deaths are in Greater Minnesota. I would like the data, please, unless you misspoke. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative O'Neill, you may well have identified another issue for us to spent some time in the event that there were some other hearings as well. I know that the AG's Department of Public Safety work group on what was it, use of force? Can't remember the exact name of the work group. They came and did a presentation for us. I recall the 60% having to do with use of force. I'm not sure it was limited to that week. Use of force, but I don't quote me on that. But you know, your point is, let's have a conversation based on good data, And I think that's fair, and I appreciate you sharing your county's experience, but there's 87 counties throughout the state. And so I'm sure that there's a quite a big picture story that needs to be covered from this committee. Representative Lucero, and then we're going to move on to the testifiers because I know one needs to leave relatively soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few comments based on some of the things that were mentioned already, but I do have a question for Representative Long. I was also intrigued, as Representative O'Neill was, if he would yield, please.
Representative Long.
Sure.
Smiling. I think that says he'll yield. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Long. Again, also intrigued by that 60% number. I'm not only interested in the source, but I would also be interested, you had cited the 60% of officer-involved killings, but I'd also like to know, were those all investigated, and were they determined to be justified, or were what percentage, if any, of those were determined after an investigation to not be justified? And then also, what was the race of these different officers versus the person who died? Do you have that information readily available? You could touch on that right now?
Representative Long, if you don't, as I indicated, I think this may be a very worthwhile conversation for this committee to have. We did have a brief hearing from Presentation Commissioner Harrington prior to the COVID restrictions imposed here. So I think it's absolutely fair play that we go over this ground carefully as we push forward with the need to stop the police brutality that we've seen, unfortunately.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I can respond to, I can answer some of the questions. So this is from the working group report from the commissioner and attorney general. There have been 100 deadly force incidents over the past 5 years, 60% of those encounters happened in greater Minnesota. I do not have the information that you requested on how those incidents were resolved. I do know that this was looked at for the fiscal note for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension proposal to have an independent investigatory unit that was included as part of our bill. And in looking at the workload that they thought they would have for doing the independent investigations. But we'd have to turn to the BCA or somebody else to answer the other questions you have.
Very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Long. So then, and the reason I was, I'd be interested in some of those greater breakdowns is I believe it was Saturday or Sunday, and I don't remember if it was the Star Tribune or the Pioneer Press, but I read an article actually that was talking about one of the other three officers involved in the tragedy of George Floyd. And to find out that he was Black, I was unaware of that. That I believe that one of the other three officers was Asian, if my memory serves. But now we have at least 50% then, an Asian and a Black African-American that were involved in the George Floyd that were minorities, that were present. And so I just found that to be very intriguing and definitely important information when it comes to whether it be unlawful use of force or authorized use of force, what that breakdown might be. But then in regards to the there was a discussion here in the Senate, and I just heard Representative Moeller speaking about how it was 11 proposals and 5 bills. And if those proposals were in 5 bills on the House side, why weren't those advanced? If there's agreement on at least 5 bills, why didn't we move those along? Why did the House decide to hold everything hostage instead of making at least some progress on the things that we can agree on? And I think that was very disappointing, especially when many of us were awake for most of Saturday night there waiting for the House to agree to the proposals that where there was a shared, again, agreement in moving something forward. And I think part of the sticking point, which I am thankful that the Senate does not agree to, is the House proposals that included provisions that have nothing, absolutely zero, to do with police accountability, such as felons voting, right? When we have felons that are currently serving their sentence and it has not yet been completed, and the House decides to include provisions like that in their package and on police reform and police accountability, it's clear that there's something more than police accountability as part of the House agenda. And then bail, right? Cash bail, nothing to do with police accountability. But to include provisions like this, again, I'm very thankful that we can slow down here and have a more deliberative conversation, that the Senate, being traditionally the more deliberative body, put the brakes on some of these very bad proposals that the House was trying to push forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. The very deliberate body only ever held an informational hearing on these proposals. And part of the reason for the walkthrough of the comparison was so that you and others can be real clear about what was on the table from both sides. And the issues that you claim had nothing to do with the issue, we can certainly debate that. Bike restore vote or cash bail were not part of the House's attempt to move something forward. Those were left out. Nevertheless, the Senate put in an employment background check that had nothing to do with the brutal killing of a Minnesota citizen at the hand of a licensed state police officer. So perhaps, you know, part of your question, I think it's absolutely appropriate that you ask the question of your House colleagues on why it was a failure to get to agreement. But quite frankly, that is also a more than fair question as well. But I am certainly hopeful in terms of, you know, further hearings here that will allow us to dig into some of the issues that you've raised. I can tell you in terms of the officers in Minneapolis, I'm not certain about their racial background, but I do know for a fact that all four state licensed peace officers in the state of Minnesota, that they do have in common. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sitting here grappling with what the race of the four officers has to do with anything we're talking about. It seems to be sort of far outside and in many ways is a distraction. And to the point about the five original bills of the Senate, I mean, one of the key parts of the package that we put together was that it actually had accountability as part of it. And I think that when we look at the original five of the Senate, although they said lots of nice things, there wasn't any accountability associated with it. And that becomes a key point. And I know there's been some concern expressed about MPD. And you know, I mean, a lot of this gets back to accountability, you know, and the role that, that the process by which officers go to overturn complaints is something that has not worked. And it hasn't just been, you know, the Minneapolis police chief and the Minneapolis mayor talking about that. It's been many, many other individuals. So when we talk about the issue of the House's package versus Senate's package, the House clearly had some accountability measures and some ability for, penalties and consequences for those peace officers. So I think it's important that folks listening understand those differences. And I know we've got testifiers and, we have a committee that could talk all day long. So I'll end my comments there.
I appreciate that, Chair Dean. And in fact, we do have some presenters. I do know that Representative Johnson wants to speak, but Representative Johnson, I'm going to put you at the very top of that list, the very top. I do want to get these presenters and respect their time. And so at this point, I would call on...
Chair Mariani, I have the statistics in front of me that was asked upon in the number of deaths across the state, and misinformation has already spoken. I'd like to clear that up.
Well, Representative Johnson, we do have individuals we've asked to come and testify. We asked them to start participating a half hour ago. I would be, the chair will absolutely allow you to share that information.
I'll just give one bit of information, and that was the amount of greater Minnesota that is not 60%. Since 2000, the year 2000, there's been 60 officer-involved shooting, equaling only 31% of the officer-involved shootings. We've had a total of 195 across the state since the year 2000.
Thank you for that, Representative Johnson. I'm going to call out our presenters. So first off, it's Chief Kelly McCarthy, who's chair of the Peace Officers and Standards Training Board, and she's going to speak to the issue of licensing reform from her perspective. And so with that, welcome to the committee, Chief McCarthy.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. Again, my name is Kelly McCarthy, and I'm the current chair of the Minnesota Peace Officers Standards and Training Board. I've also been a licensed police officer going on 21 years now. The next few years are going to be critical for the Post Board, for policing, and for who we are as Minnesotans. The Post Board recognizes the need for us to make systematic changes, some of which are already underway. The type of real change that we are committed to takes time, and this is where we need your help. We need the legislature to be the voice of all people in Minnesota and make the immediate statutory changes necessary to help us build legitimacy and organizational capacity. There's a common saying that people fear change, but what we actually fear is the potential loss that change represents. There is no loss, there is no downside to the legislature acting out of an ethic of care for all citizens and for the good of hardworking peace officers doing their job right every day. But if we, after watching a man killed by police while he called for his mother, retreat to political position, succumb to fear, and fail to act, we are at risk of losing our good officers who feel unsupported. And more importantly, we're at risk of losing our collective humanity as citizens of Minnesota. I thank you and the committee for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief McCarthy. And thank you for the work that you're doing at the Pulse Board. Continue to look forward to coordinate our efforts in terms of how state law can be helpful to you and your colleagues as you move forward in a modernizing effort at our Pulse Board. I believe next we have, I'll make sure it was available because I know someone needed to step out. I think it's Mary Moriarty, our Hennepin County Public Defender, who will speak on use of force doctrine. Public Defender Moriarty.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. I first wanted to say, I actually grew up in Wall, Minnesota, and my dad was a lawyer there. And so I knew all of the police officers there, and I knew many of them to be respectful and kind, and some less so. When I came, I've been a public defender for 30 years and chief for the last 6 years. And I work on committees right now with police officers from Minneapolis and from the suburbs. And many of the police officers I work with are true peace officers, and they are kind and respectful, and I have no doubt that they treat members of our community that way. But I'm also aware that there are police officers who don't do their jobs that way. Several years ago, and this was before Chief Arredondo was chief, he invited me to participate in a day-long procedural justice training with his officers. It was me and 20 police officers. There were a couple of things that stood out to me that day. One was that the actual implicit bias procedural justice training was quite good. But I remember being at small tables, and I was at a table with a lieutenant who, when the officers were asked what their goals were for the next year, said, "I want to maintain the warrior mentality because that's why I became a police officer." There was also a discussion about language. Police officers are supposed to use respectful language, and they were being coached about that. And several of the officers said, "Those people won't follow my commands unless I use F words." And I remember walking out of that training thinking, this is really good training, but culture change is going to take a long time. because there are some in the department, and not only MPD, who have this warrior mentality. So I said this is not just MPD, and as Chief Public Defender in Hennepin County, we represent clients on felonies and misdemeanors all over Hennepin County. I can tell you there's one suburban police officer who has been found to have violated our client's constitutional rights six times, and continues to be called as a witness in cases here. So I'm also familiar with many public defenders across the state who also share stories of the things that police officers do there. So I want to say affirmatively, there are both good police officers and some who are not so much all over the state. As public defender, we look at body cam and we look at dash cam, and we see police officers. Some of them are respectful, some of them are not. Some of them verbally abuse and physically abuse our clients. One of the things that one of the things that many people in our office have said to me since George Floyd was murdered was that they see George Floyd all the time. They see George Floyd all the time, but the knee is removed in time. So one of the things I want to emphasize here, I'm talking about the use of force policy, but there's some language in here that's not just about use of force. And one of the things that people don't understand, because they have no reason to understand it, is rough and abusive behavior happens frequently. Mm-hmm. It's only when it becomes the George Floyd that the universe, that the world finds out about it. And there's some things about the House use of force policy, which I think are just outstanding. And one of them I want to read. It says that the authority to use deadly force conferred on peace officers by this section is a critical responsibility that shall be exercised judiciously and with respect for human rights and dignity for the sanctity of every human life. The legislature further finds and declares that every person has a right to be free from excessive use of force by officers acting under color of law. And to me, that says to peace officers, it's not just about deadly force, but it's how you approach the day-to-day interactions with our clients. And this is critical. We see many of our clients charged with obstruction of legal process, which essentially is resisting arrest. And that often happens because an officer approaches a community member in an abusive, either language or physical or forceful way. And the community member doesn't feel that they're being treated respectfully, and it escalates. And sometimes it escalates to the point where a client is injured and maybe a police officer is injured. And I particularly like the language here that talks about peace officers should exercise special care when interacting with individuals with physical, mental health, developmental, or intellectual disabilities, as an individual's disability may affect the individual's ability to understand or comply with commands from peace officers. I think those are critical components that help send a message to peace officers about what we expect in Minnesota. I also think when it talks about a reasonable officer, one of the things I think we hear complaints about is that a police officer can say, well, I was afraid. And that justifies any use of force. What I think is notable here is that because of the other language here, the fact that peace officers are directed to understand that there's dignity and sanctity in every human life, and that every person has a right to be free from excessive use of force. That's not just deadly force, it's excessive use of force. And so that tells police officers, when you approach a situation, a reasonable peace officer is looking for other available resources and techniques if reasonably safe and feasible to an objectively reasonable officer. What I think we need is our legislature to declare what our values are as Minnesotans. And I think it's important for peace officers. It's only fair for them to understand what the expectations are. I also think it will avoid many situations that we see. It will help with accountability. And I think it will help us avoid the next George Floyd. Thank you so much for this invitation.
Thank you, Chief Public Defender Moriarty, for your words of wisdom, advice, and reflection, and also for the fine work that you do for the citizens of Maricopa County. Thank you. Next, we have Mayor Carter scheduled, so I'm just putting out a query to staff to see if the mayor is available.
I am, sir.
Yes, very well. My mayor, Mayor Melvin Carter, here to speak on the need to modernize, is my word, our approach to public safety that adds new practices to the use of licensed police officers. That was one of the components of the House provision, particularly around our community-led public safety efforts. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you very much, Chair Mariani, members of the committee. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to join you here today. As we all know and has been reflected in the comments already, a very critical conversation that not only all of our constituents in Minnesota are watching closely, but that literally all of the world is watching as the Twin Cities has served as ground zero to a national awakening right now. As we continue to move through this public health and economic crisis, the death of George Floyd and the generations old trauma that has led the cries for justice continues to impact so many of us. As gridlock on police reform takes hold at the federal level, now's the time for us to take real meaningful steps toward addressing this culture of public safety that's focused far too long on simply police, prisons, and prosecutors across our country and right here in Minnesota. The anger and outrage that we've seen across our country is an energy that at times feels like it's tearing our country apart. But I'm confident that this very same energy is the energy that abolished slavery. It's the energy that ushered in civil rights in America. And it's the same energy that's carried our nation through every trying moment. So it's vital that we join together against this injustice and do this work of improving our systems, improving our policies, and fixing those laws that are broken. You know, the conversation we're having in St. Paul right now has been that a public safety framework that starts after something bad has happened, a public safety framework that centers around getting someone to the scene as fast as possible after a crime has been committed is just woefully inadequate. Can you turn off the TV, please? Sorry. woefully inadequate for us. We need the types of proactive investments on the front end that can help us reduce the likelihood that something bad will happen in the first place in all of our neighborhoods. In America, we spend nearly $200 billion a year, every year, on law enforcement and corrections, on prisons and police. And we maintain the highest imprisonment rate on the planet, by far. Yet despite three decades of steady public safety spending increases, if you look at Gallup data, polling data over the last three decades, it shows that Americans report, about two-thirds of Americans still report feeling less and less safe every year. And the reason is because these public safety heavy strategies aren't designed to address the root causes of crime, just the symptoms. So we have to know that no amount of enforcement can really bring real peace and security to a neighborhood that's languishing in poverty, nor can systems that only further alienate those on the outer edges of society do that either, while impeding funding that we need for critical social infrastructure like schools and housing. I've shared that my father's story, having served St. Paul for 28 years on the St. Paul Police Department. And my argument is that until we start to fix these disconnects, that even officers like him will just risk being perceived as armed enforcers of the status quo, of this logically defunct status quo. So we need a modern vision for public safety that focuses on these systemic changes and investments that address the conditions that lead people to act out in desperation in the first place. So I want to share with you that in St. Paul, we started this journey 3 years ago when I first came in office by completely rewriting the policies governing use of force, completely rewriting the policies governing deployment of police dogs. And as the world turns its attention to those other three officers who helped while Officer Chauvin killed George Floyd and did not intervene, we've also terminated officers whose actions betrayed our public trust. This time last year, our chief of police announced the termination of five officers who failed to intervene in a assault in progress. To support residents' economic well-being, we've raised the minimum wage, built new housing supports, and done a lot of things like that. And we've also developed our Community First Public Safety Plan, which uses a public health lens to not only treat the symptoms of our public safety challenges, but also the root causes. Our investment includes jobs and resources for youth, focused on young people who've interfaced with our juvenile justice system. It includes housing and mental health supports, including connecting residents to safe, stable, and supportive housing, while connecting people in need to mental health supports and resources. And most critically, we're engaging in this public health approach to violence prevention through community ambassadors that work to connect youth to programs, services, and employment opportunities, and a healing streets model, which incorporates community-centered healing-based approaches for violence prevention, intervention, and healing. I want you to know that this public health model, we've heard police chiefs say all over the country and all over the state for years that violence is a public health crisis. And when we take what we've acknowledged as a public health crisis and meet it over and over and over again with law enforcement tools, then we're just failing on an implementation level. We have to meet this with implementation tools. Just as we're addressing this crisis right now by saying, how do we test? How do we treat? How do we do social distancing and masking so that we are limiting the spread? Research has shown for a very long time that violence, in particular gun violence, acts like a pandemic, that in the same way as the biggest predictor of a case of coronavirus is whether you've been around someone with coronavirus, the biggest predictor of an incident of violence is a preceding act of violence. And so this public health approach centers in much in the same way as we're approaching our COVID-19 crisis, centers around identifying who has been around violence, who has been traumatized by violence, who else may have been touched by this spread, how we as a community work to engage and to intervene with those individuals to limit the spread in the future. And these types of approaches have been very successful based on independent evaluation in building, again, not just a crime response after something bad happens, but a real public safety framework that helps to proactively make neighborhoods across our country and across our world safer. Just as we seek to reshape our system at the local level through these measures and others like addressing the police union contracts, which too often shield officers from being held accountable, our actions must also include addressing the laws at the state level to ensure our systems deliver justice. That's why now more than ever, we have a critical opportunity to reshape our thinking about public safety into this new vision, this bigger vision that can help heal this generations old trauma that we've seen expressed through our country, in particular over the last month. I want to thank you again, Chair Mariani, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today and for your work in ensuring this new vision, in ushering this new vision forward for all of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor Carter. And at some point, I'd love to get from you just what some of those independent evaluation studies are showing us relative to some multiplicity of approaches and comprehensive nature of addressing violence as a public health issue. It does seem to me that very quickly that, part of the fear, and Chief McCarthy spoke about this at the very, very beginning, that, change, there's a fear element to change. But I think one of the things that is helpful for me, and I hope will be helpful for other public policy folks as well as regular citizens, and I hope that they can embrace this, is that we, I think, have an opportunity to build on, quite frankly, for the most part, pretty good, smart, community-based policing. we know that there are good practices in law enforcement, just as we struggle with bad practices, just as we struggle with systems issues that create lack of accountability that then creates all sorts of other problems. The other side of that coin is that, and I know this is from personal interactions with my own neighbors who are in law enforcement, some who serve in our police department in St. Paul, that there's some really sound practices and attitudes and behaviors that we can build on to round out what we're doing. I think the issue is, will we build on it, and how do we round that out? So I'm really looking forward to us continuing to push on that front as we also continue to push on high quality professional level accountability when it comes to our police practices in our state. Members, we are a little bit behind. I am was going to stop at this point to have questions for these three. I still want to do that, but what I'd like to do is see if Professor Joel Sass is available, because I'd like him to give the final presentation, and then see how we're doing with time. We'll circle around back to questions, and hopefully our presenters stick around. They're very busy people, but you know, to engage a little bit in question and answer. And so just a signal for someone that Professor Sass is available would be helpful.
Yeah, I'm here.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Professor. You are an instructor over at the University of Minnesota at the Humphrey Institute.
Yeah, I'm over at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs.
Very well. You know what? I'm going to stop there and just let you introduce yourself and then go forward with some of the thoughts you want to share with us today.
Great. First of all, thank you to the chair and to the members of the committee for having me here today. I actually want to start with a cautionary note about my testimony. When people who usually don't get much of a say in government and politics go into the streets to try to make their voices heard, public officials often call in people like me who are considered experts in some way to explain what protesters want, why they're upset, and what can be done about it. And in this way, I think people like me who are already getting listened to in lots of different venues sometimes get turned into a kind of substitute for community voices that are really desperately trying to be heard. So I just want to sort of start by emphasizing that people in Minnesota right now are speaking for themselves and asking for this group's attention. And so the most important goal for this committee, I should hope, is to listen directly to voices that are coming out of Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities that have experienced a great deal of injustice perpetrated in the name of what we typically call criminal justice. In my testimony today, what I hope to do is not to speak for those protests in any way, but rather to draw on a large, long-standing body of research to provide some context for understanding our current moment of what the committee has described as civil unrest in its invitation to me. The police killing of George Floyd has horrified and galvanized and mobilized people in Minnesota and throughout the nation and around the world, in fact. The life taken from George Floyd by officers sworn to protect and serve his community demands a central place in our moral and our political obligations right now. But it would be a mistake, I'd like to suggest, to interpret what's happening now in terms of the political response as a sort of narrow response to this single event, to begin and to end our understanding with the observation that while people are angry about what police did to George Floyd, so they've been protesting and rioting. I'd like to encourage us to understand today's civil unrest, as the committee has called it, in a broader context in three ways, all of which I think speak to the committee's question of how to prevent civil unrest in the future. First, I think we need to locate the current protests in a longer history of freedom struggles and uprisings. Throughout U.S. history, police and policing have been central to Black, Brown, and Indigenous freedom struggles. When the Federal Kerner Commission on Civil Disorders issued its report on urban riots throughout the United States in 1968, it presented compelling evidence that among a wide array of racial injustices, the activities of police stood at the top of grievances cited by protesters. When Dr. Kenneth Clark spoke to that commission, he famously reflected on reading the report of the 1919 riot in Chicago, saying, quote, "And it is as if I were reading the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 1935, the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 1943, the report of the McCone Commission on the 1965 Watts riot. I must again in candor say to you, members of this commission, it is a kind of Alice in Wonderland, with the same moving picture shown over again, the same analysis, the same recommendations, and the same inaction. Police stood at the center of the Los Angeles uprisings in the early 1990s, and police stood at the center of political demands when people mobilized around the movement for Black Lives 5 years ago. My first point, then, is that we have been in this situation for a very long time. Our most heavily policed communities have been protesting these issues for as long as any of us here have been alive. Disruptive mass action is usually triggered by some kind of immediate event, but it's crucial to understand that mass protest, including what we're experiencing right now, has been a recurrent periodic feature of a society that, despite its many reports and despite its many reform efforts, has not fundamentally eradicated the injustices that surround policing in our society. Second, I'd like to locate the recent protests in the context of a large body of research on policing in Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. The repeated findings of research, it should be said, generally echo and support the concerns emphasized by community leaders, organizations, and activists. Three kinds of problems stand out. First are problems that are usually called problems of over-policing. Saturation policing in communities focused on controlling public spaces and behaviors. The problems here include racially targeted forms of harassment and violence, of course, but they're fundamentally rooted in models of policing that emphasize a heavy, visible presence and position police officers as agents continually surveilling and controlling social environments. Second, problems of failed policing. Despite the fact that they live in neighborhoods that are saturated with police, research clearly shows that people in lower income communities of color also suffer from significant ongoing failures of public safety. Not surprisingly, calls to dismantle police and reimagine public safety today echo a long line of calls from Black communities in particular to do something more effective to protect people, to make crime preventing investments in social services and community development, and to do a better job of investigating violations of public safety. And then third, problems of pocketbook policing. Since the 1990s, police have played a growing role in stripping resources from communities that they police and turning them into government revenues and, in some cases, corporate profits. Fines have expanded in size and scope. Police routinely ticket people in the poorest neighborhoods for simply moving around in public in their own neighborhoods, driving, bicycling, walking. Asset forfeiture procedures are used in all sorts of ways to take small or large amounts of cash or cars or whatever without any need to even charge the individual with a crime. In these and other ways, people in heavily policed communities experience police as a daily part of life, controlling and threatening in many ways, but far less than reliable as a source of personal security and public safety. So when we think about how mass protests have repeatedly focused on police in the U.S., we should be clear that there's a great deal of agreement between scholarly research and community activists when it comes to the core problems. Third and finally, the protests that have arisen in response to the killing of George Floyd should be viewed as one form of political action within the context of other forms of political action. The historical record and studies of protests make one point abundantly clear for us. People who feel that the political system is responsive to them rarely pursue their goals by rioting or rising up even in peaceful mass protests. Popular uprisings of the sort we're going through now tend to occur when people believe that government officials have been and will continue to be unresponsive to them, that efforts pursued through more conventional political processes will once again fail to produce real change. Here in Minnesota, people have been organizing and working hard on these issues for a very long time. They've campaigned for and elected mayors and police chiefs committed to reform. They've participated in reform commissions. They've lobbied to change rules and procedures. As community members have pursued the movement for Black Lives, they've also produced detailed policy proposals for consideration and adoption. And time after time, they failed to see a fundamental shift in what police are and do in their lives. Police harassment, violence, and killings have not stopped. Inadequate public safety has not been made adequate, and the continual fines and fees and other financial charges have continued. When conventional political work of this sort repeatedly fails, there is a tried and true way to finally get the attention of policymakers, and we've been experiencing it over the past month. In fact, it's the reason why we're having this hearing right now, a hearing that likely would not have happened otherwise. Based on what we know from decades of careful study, I'd like to end by suggesting that people whose goal is to prevent future uprisings should perhaps see themselves as aligned with people whose goal is to fundamentally reimagine public safety. Because as I've already said, when government officials and agencies are responsive to what communities want, need, and hope for, when they effectively confront injustices and work creatively and democratically to build something better, they're very unlikely to be met with a mass uprising. When government is already listening and responding, people rarely turn to rioting and mass protests to get their attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Soss. I really appreciate your insight and your work on this area in general. I could tell you we haven't fully gotten to know each other yet, but I look forward to getting to know you a little bit better and hearing more from you. But I can tell you that in our committee, for the last couple of years, but you know, frankly, even predating that, there has been some efforts here of responding to what we're now calling reimagining. There's been some good bipartisan support, for instance, on alternatives to incarceration, and I think that does reflect both knowledge and a wisdom and a desire for something different than what we currently have as the do-all and end-all and be-all of our public safety system. Thank you for being with us today. I look forward to our continued interaction. I have several members. So I'm going to do this for about 15 minutes, and then I'll call it in because that'll pretty much take us to what a typical committee length will be. I'll entertain, the chair will entertain some questions and comments, and then we'll be on our way. I think we did a really good job today of doing the kind of focus that we need to be doing at this point in time. So with that, I'm going to call on, let's see, someone who hasn't spoken, Representative Edelson.
Oh, thank you, Chair Mariani. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, I'm with all my kids, and so I had to kind of step out of the room. Yes. So I want to just thank all the testifiers today. It's been really helpful to hear their thoughts and perspectives. As a mom that's a legislator and I represent the suburbs, it's been really interesting to see how all of this has gone about and some of the comments that our community has provided me in the emails that I've received. A lot of them, and so I live in, people have like an envisionment of what they think of Edina. I live in the Country Club neighborhood is what it's called. And overwhelmingly, our district doesn't have a lot of, specifically this neighborhood doesn't have a lot of lawn signs. What has been really powerful for me is to see all the Black Lives Matter signs. And it is Republicans and Democrats coming together to say, this is what's happening in Minnesota. It's not okay. We have not only what's happening with policing, but what's happening in our educational systems. If you're a Black student, you have the worst outcomes. Why is that? And so as a mom, I'm really concerned that we are not, when we have an offer on the table, that I expect that the Senate will send us an offer back. And these are moderate proposals. I mean, I hear a lot about defunding police. There's nothing in our proposals that defund police. And so I think the Minnesota people are tired. They're tired of our inaction. The rioting happened because of civil unrest. I think the professor laid it out very well. Does policing work for you? Policing works for you based on a lot of times your socioeconomic status. So I think that we have a lot of soul searching to do. This is not about party politics. And I don't want any of our colleagues to think that it is. They know deep down in their hearts that it's not. And so we have work to do. Thank you, Chair Mariani, for holding this committee.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Thank you for your work as someone who's actually walked on both sides, if you will, outside of our public safety and correction system. I did get a question here. Someone did email a question in. And so I want to read this. And I think if Chief McCarthy's around still, feel free to make a stab at all or part of this. The question is, who has the authority to hold the Pulse Board accountable since it operates outside of the Department of Public Safety? I think that's true, but maybe a little clarity on that. The board doesn't oversee discipline of officers, instead defers to the agency of employment. Under this oversight, license revocation in Minnesota is unlikely without a criminal conviction. So if the chief is here, if she wishes to offer just some comments on that.
I am, Chair.
Oh, wonderful. Did you hear the question or the comment?
Yes, sir. So I believe the first part is, to whom does the Post Board report?
Yes, right.
And we are statutorily required to report to both the governor and the attorney general. And our decisions of discipline are can be reviewed by, I believe it's the Court of Appeals. And then the second question was discipline and or regards to discipline, and it's absolutely correct. The Post Board does not have purview over behavior that doesn't rise to the level of a criminal conviction, being a gross misdemeanor, a felony, and some misdemeanors, outside of sexual harassment or engaging in the use of deadly force.
All right, very well. Let me push on then. Representative
Moeller. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And something that Mayor Carter said that really resonated with me was the issue of not really getting to the cause of the problem. And I can tell you that as a prosecutor for about 20 years now, I've read a lot of pre-sentence investigations. And those are the reports that are done prior to sentencing in felony cases. And they really go into a defendant's background, family background, school background, employment history, of course, criminal history. And it's always astounding to me how many times systems have failed these defendants in the past. And as we learn more about children and brain development and ACE scores, you know, you see so many things that have happened to a person in their lifetime. And many of these are young people still, and you just think where we've gone wrong. There are so many opportunities where systems, the state, the county, the city could have intervened in this life, and we wouldn't be here where we are right now. And so that's something that I'm really interested in looking at, and I'm just want to say thanks to Mayor Carter for bringing up the fact that often we're not solving what the problem actually is.
Mayor, any comments?
No, I appreciate that, and I will look forward to your comments, Mr. Chair, as well.
I lost.
I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I got muted. We do have some of the research basis that shows the impacts of youth summer jobs, for example, which have been shown to have significant reductions on youth crime rates, on after-school programs, on like community-based community interveners and those types of things. We do have a significant amount of that research to share. It's out there if you're looking for it. So thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have two other hands that I'm showing, although one was up for a while. Representative Lucero, is that from a prior hand raising?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I do have a hand up, but I was up. I'll let Representative Long go first because mine was up from earlier. I do have a question, but so I just kept it up. But
go ahead. You have a floor, but it's fine.
Okay, sounds good. Just a few comments. I was intrigued by Mayor Carter's comments. actually, let me first respond to Representative Dean from earlier when he asked the question, what does race have to do with it? That really puzzled me because what I've been hearing back when we had the regular session happening, the special session over and over and over again was systemic racism, institutional racism, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm puzzled at what Representative Dean doesn't understand about what race has to do with it and the race of the officers that were involved, because if other minority officers were involved, it may have a change in the dialogue that's being spoken of. To Mayor Carter, thank you for joining and thank you for your comments today. One of the comments you made was that police unions shield from being held accountable. And I'm wondering, do you think that phenomena is unique to police unions, or would that phenomena potentially extend to all unions?
Well, and, Mayor Carter, we are talking about police and law enforcement here, but I'll let you speak for yourself. And you're muted. You're muted, sir.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, Representative Lucero. I'll share that as we discuss systemic racism and institutional racism, I think it's important to remember that this conversation goes far beyond individuals. And so I wouldn't seek to paraphrase Representative Dean. I know he can speak for himself, but I will share that what I was trying to comment on for you earlier is a system that sets both our officers of any race and our communities up for failure. By failing to invest in the community level of interventions that we all know that we need and that our officers acknowledge that we need, as they say, as they lament their inability to have the capacity or expertise to serve as the social workers or chemical health therapists, et cetera, that we all know that our communities need. When I hear our officers say, I can't be all of those things, I hear them asking us for investment in all of those things. And so we certainly have to acknowledge that race plays an incredible factor in outcomes, as people of color, and particularly Black and Brown Americans, have been shown to be stopped more, to be pulled over more, to be searched more, to be charged more, to have disparities at literally every decision step along the criminal justice system, and that those impacts have been shown to have a snowballing effect. I don't think that there's any logical or scientific argument that there are not still institutional and systemic disparities that play out in those systems. And I think we can get distracted, I think, by what the races of those individuals are. And I imagine that what Representative Dean was saying is we need to be addressing this at a systemic level and not just on an individual basis if our goal is to prevent this from recurring over and over and over again. Representative Lucero, I can't pretend to be the expert on all things unions of all unions. What I can tell you is that we have a phenomenon that has played out over and over and over again in Minnesota and around the country, and that is with unarmed, unaggressive, in particular Black and Brown men and women losing their lives at the hands of the people who we as a government system empower with a badge and an unlimited power to wield. And unless we are willing to engage, unless we are willing to transform these systems to ensure that both those officers and our community members know that we won't accept that and we will hold them accountable when something like that happens, then, you know, we will be complicit in the continued cycle of this cycle, which frankly is inevitable to continue to play out until we do something to stop it.
I'll start, Mr. Mayor. Representative Dean, I saw your hand pop up, I suspect, partly in response to...
And Mr. Chair, I had one more question for the mayor.
Representative Lucero, I'll come right back to you. I'm just asking Representative Dean, since you invoked his name and I saw his name popped up, if there's a related comment here.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Mayor Carter did a good job. I was talking about the race of the officers having nothing to do with the conversation relative to what happened to George Floyd. It wouldn't have mattered, you know, what the race, whether even it was all four. I mean, these are systems and institutions that are based on racism. And, you know, it doesn't mean that everybody involved in the systems are racist in and of themselves. So we need to be really, really clear when we're talking about systematic racism and institutional racism versus the race of a particular individual, or you know, whether an individual is a racist or not. So just to clarify, it's clearly the race of the officers involved in the murder of George Floyd aren't the relevant issue. It's the institution that has allowed that to happen. And as the professor spoke, it's real clear that this happens. And as you know, the chief public defender, this happens all the time. It's just that this time it was actually caught on video, and we all saw the inhumanity for that. And I'll leave it at that. I look forward to continued conversations about this as we actually try to implement change that will actually have a effect on those communities and those individuals that for far too long it's had the exact opposite negative impact on them.
Yeah, indeed, and I will work, members, to create some more opportunities for us to dig in with one another and dig in deeper with this. Representative Lucero, I'll let you have one follow-up because we also have a couple of other members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the indulgence. So just following up on Representative Dean's comments here, I am intrigued and somewhat baffled at the same time. So are we saying that it's is the conjecture that it's non-racist police officers that are operating within a racist system, and that's what led to the actions? Or are we saying that it is the actions of the tragedy that occurred by racist officers? And if I heard Representative Dean correctly, it was the system itself that's racist, but not necessarily the individuals that were operating
Mr. Chair, I'll just respond quickly.
I do not mean to badger at all. I'm honestly seeking just clarity.
Hold on. I do have three other members that I want to get to. Let me just say this. I am more than open to continuing this conversation. I will point out, we began this last regular session specifically to have a conversation about the intersection of race and the law, and particularly race and the law and police functions. We had national experts, actually, on police accountability, who came and spent time with us. And so we're not going to get to what we need to get to in quick back and forth, but we should have those back and forth. And so I will certainly structure those opportunities for us in the coming days. I would urge anyone who was not at that hearing, we had several members of both committees, it was a joint committee here, that weren't there. I would urge you strongly to go to the webpage and spend some time going over the material and the testimony that was offered at that time. I have three other members I want to get to quickly. Representative Ivey, you've had your hand up for a while. So I'm going to go to you, then Representative O'Neill, and then Representative Long, you'll close us out. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mariotti. For Mayor Carter, I just have two quick questions. You reported several changes in policies that you've made in kind of reimagining your police department there. How many of those did you go to the legislature for permission for, and how many of them did you just decide to do because they were the right things to do?
Mr. Mayor.
Representative Chair Mariani, Representative Navani, I appreciate the question. Many of those things have been within our prerogative to do. Frankly, as we talk about the need to revisit arbitration, that's one in particular that we specifically need the state to intervene on, to give us the permission to allow us to change that arbitration process. As you may be aware right now, we work with the unions to agree on a set of arbitrators who have a business case to bring us back sort of 50-50 results, findings, half that, you know, in favor of the city and half in favor of the union. And I'm looking for an arbitration process that really allows those arbitrators to be independent and not to worry that they'll be disbarred as arbitrators from either the city or the union by doing what they believe is in the right interests of our residents. I'll tell you this, I am a young African-American man who happens to drive sometimes beyond the limits of the city of St. Paul. And when I do, I want to be safe as well. And so while you're right, there are significant changes that I can make as a mayor to the way that we police. There are significant changes that our police chief can make. And thankfully, we have a strong and a committed chief who has been focused on what he calls the bank of trust and ensuring that our officers' actions meet three tests, reasonable, necessary, and respectful at all times. If this is something that we think needs to be an ethic that we maintain consistently across the state level, well, that's what the state legislature is for. And that's why we need your actions. We need your engagement. We need your intervention in this. In the last conversation, I was thinking about one of my favorite Martin Luther King quotes, when he said, "It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me." And I think that's pretty important too. I'm hoping we don't get distracted by a census of who's racist and who's not. And I'm hoping that those of you who we entrust with the sacred work of building systems at the statewide level that can support our lives and our livelihood, stay focused on those systems, on ensuring that those systems are capable of serving all of us in all of our communities all over our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ivey. I think you said you have another question. Is that correct?
Chair Mariani, thank you. Mayor Carter, you had mentioned that you had fired, I believe, 7 officers for failed here to intervene.
Our police chief did, not me.
Okay. And you get permission? 5? Did you get permission from the union to do that, or was that something that the police chief felt he had the authority to do, and I assumed you agreed with it?
The police chief, as is within his prerogative, the police chief made the determination after this went through, again, our civilian oversight commission, which is an important part of, I know, the post board reforms that you guys are considering right now. The police chief made that determination. The union has grieved those things and has taken those to arbitration. We have been fortunate to have been able to prevail in 2 of those cases so far as the arbitrator has ruled in favor of the city. But again, at the systems level, and I'm hoping we don't stay stuck on kind of exceptions. I kind of feel like as long as you have to point out exceptions as proof that something is not a problem, then that's how you know it continues to be a problem. So I'm hoping that at the systems level, we can address that. At the systems level, we continue to have an issue in which arbitrators do not have the ability to truly be independent, because it's the only space we would know if we went to court and the judge had the pressure of having to rule equally in favor of the defense and in favor of the prosecution, that we look at that as an unfair and a setup for failure that would not be meet the levels of transparency and accountability we require in our justice system. That's currently the case in our arbitration systems. That's why it's critical that we take that out of negotiation between the city and those unions, take that up to a level that allows those arbitrators to truly be independent. All right.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so glad to see Mayor Carter back. I was going to say something to him last time that we all were together, and he popped off the call before I could say something. But first, I just want to commend you for your words and your tone and your tenor that you took as this civil unrest and the riots and the looting began, and you just had like the perfect words to say, and I didn't know if there was such a thing, but as I watched you from afar, as much of Minnesota did in the press conference after press conference, I just felt that you had such a strong voice, both to speak for the protesters, obviously, that were impacted, or the people were impacted, but also the business owners who were impacted, and saying, we're not going to take that here, we're not going to tolerate looting and burning, and that's not the way to do this. And so, first of all, I just wanted to say that. I was going to say that the last time you were here and you hopped off the call. But I feel like there's so many things that you and I I would like to ask you things. I'm not going to take the committee's time to do that, but if you and I could have an offline conversation, I feel like I could learn so much from you. And I'm actually, it's my birthday today, and I'm actually headed to St. Paul to celebrate. My daughter lives down there, and so I'll be celebrating a very, very small celebration, obviously, but we'll be heading there soon. But the last thing I wanted to say, Mayor Carter, is also what you just said about arbitration. And I've done a fair bit of studying about the system currently. And I could not agree more that the current arbitration system is broken for the obvious reasons that you just spoke of. And in the behind the scenes negotiations that I was a part of, more so I pushed myself into it that I was invited. That was something that was at a high level, very important to both sides, is to fix this broken arbitration system. And so that is why the Senate proposed actually kind of throwing out that system and trying a different system that seems to work a bit better, which is administrative law judges looking at it, who have no interest, no personal interest in the outcome. They just look at the facts and through a preponderance of evidence make their decisions. So I would hope that we can move an idea like that forward. Obviously, just at this point to deal with the law enforcement folks, but there was an amendment that I had put forth that was a broader conversation, but obviously this conversation is about law enforcement. But in any case, I wanted to first commend you of the tone and tenor that you took as all of this crisis unfolded, and asked if we could continue this conversation, so I won't take up the committee's time, but I feel like there's a lot that I could learn from you if you would indulge me, Mayor Carter. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mayor Carter.
Representative, I'd be honored. Thank you for your kind words and happy birthday.
Thank
indeed,
you.
Indeed, a blessed birthday to you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Johnson, and then Representative Long, and then we're gonna wrap it up, folks. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, Mayor Carter, I want to thank you for the work you've done. You've been able to tackle a lot of these issues already in your city and with your department without any legislative requirements. There's a couple things that we need to work on. Some we agree on, some we disagree on, but I think we can get there. And we can do a lot of it without legislative action. The issue with the arbitrators, we know we need to work on that. It's a bad system, not just in law enforcement, but all over public employees. In fact, in 2018, a Minneapolis public school teacher actually choked a sixth grader and was mimicking him. He ended up finally agreeing to resign from the position, but the PELSB gave him his license back after a 6-month suspension when choking was could be a felony assault and should have gotten jail time. Instead, he got nothing and got his license back after assaulting a sixth grader. So it's a problem not just in law enforcement, it's a problem throughout the entire system that we actually need to really dive into and fix. There are some other things I was going to comment on, but one thing I want to comment on for the rest of this committee and for the people sitting out there. In March, we ended up with this ugly situation with the COVID-19, shutting things down, doing what we can. We had the on the horrible incidents revolving George Floyd. But what's been forgotten in this whole thing since then, in February, the OLA report came out on our state correctional facilities. This is one thing that the state is responsible for. This is one thing this committee and our corrections committee, which is a subcommittee of this committee, has done absolutely nothing on. This is our responsibility. Most of the stuff in the bill that this chamber brought forward, a lot of them can do already. In fact, Minneapolis and Mayor Carter admitted
They have civilian review boards already for their law enforcement. They can do that. It's their option. Any department can do that. It's up to the local communities. The locals decide how they want. The state gives guidelines. We give them opportunities, and they get to pick what they want. In the somebody earlier talked about the working group on the deadly force encounters. If you actually read it and read the highlights, the law enforcement agency working with their communities. Law enforcement, local government should partner. It's not the state giving a sledgehammer telling you will do this. It's letting local control. If they need it, they need it. If they don't, they don't. One size fits all does not work. My size 10 shoes will not fit very well on my son with his size 7s. I can't get his size 7s on mine. We need to have guidelines, but not statutes. And Post Board and other committees do those guidelines. We have options any city can do or any sheriff's office can do. They can do a lot of these things already. We don't need to be forced feeding them these things that they have to do. Looking at some of the polls, even in Minneapolis, the majority of the people like their police department and they want their police department. They don't want it defunded. I've talked to the people in those communities, got out of my car and just walked down the street, talked to the people. They understand that their police department is very, very shorthanded. They have about 800 man department and they need 400 more. They're one third short of what they need. They can't even answer all the emergency calls. How are they going to do the community support and the community activities when they can't even answer all the calls? If your vehicle is stolen, you don't call them and they come to you. You have to go to their department and sign up form to fill it out. They don't have time to come to you to take care of the report. And if you don't go there and do the report in person, but you don't have a car to get there, you can't even do an insurance claim for your car. It's a failure in the police department. It's a failure in the city council. And it's a failure of the mayor in Minneapolis that's caused this problems that they're having. Nothing the state can do can really help that. And like Mayor Carter's done a fantastic job working with what he has to work with. I've heard good things about his department. I know a lot of those officers that work there, and they wanted to thank you for letting them actually defend their city during the riot instead of standing down and letting them burn down the precincts. So I want to commend you for that. I'm going to end there, but this is what we should be working on, taking care of and dealing with the issues in our correctional facilities, and let the communities take care of their police departments the way they need to and what works best for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. You and I certainly agree on the good work that our mayor in St. Paul has done. And let me just ask you to perhaps the redirect our shared, it's actually shared, concern over the lack of legislature responding to our corrections. You know, this body, this committee, this body heard the OLA report. The other body didn't even hear it. This body, this committee, funded the deficiency for corrections. We pushed that all the way through the floor of the House. The other body didn't even hear it, certainly didn't pass that. This body, this committee, heard the COVID recommendations to make our prisons safer, not only for the folks who reside there, but for the men and women who work there as well. The other body did not hear it, did not pass that either. And so I do share your indignation for sure on that, and I would have us all point the finger where it appropriately needs to be pointed to, which is another body that yet again checks out of the work that you so rightfully call for us to do. So let's do that together and press that other body to do its work. Members,
unfortunately,
members,
this report has nothing to do with COVID or the deficiency funding. There's a whole lot of other issues that this committee did not do.
Representative Johnson, we're going to have more hearings, and we'll talk all about that, and we'll talk about just how this body stacks up with the other body, which, quite frankly, does pretty much nothing. Representative Long, why don't you close this out here?
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Oh, Mr. Mayor, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were still here.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to respond. Representative Johnson made some points about our work in St. Paul, and I appreciate the compliments of our St. Paul police officers, and I think that they are well put. One officer said to me recently, he said, listen, I signed up for a dangerous job, and I know that it's dangerous. And he said, but it really hurts me when the actions of another officer in another city make my job all the more dangerous because the people who I show up to help look at me because they see that video and think they can trust me less. I want to share with you this. I was just quiet for 5 seconds. We've seen a video of Officer Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. I know that the 5 seconds I was just quiet was uncomfortable for us. We've seen a video of Officer Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. Every member of humanity who I know is disturbed, is unwilling to accept that. Every member of humanity that I know in community believes we ought to do every single thing, Representative, in our power to prevent that from happening again. And we know that it's a cycle because just a few years ago, we were equally shocked by the death of Philando Castile as we watched the way that that played out. I would encourage this body that to represent the urgency, to represent the desires, to represent the passion of our state and our neighbors around this, that if you're approaching this from the perspective, what are all the things that can be done without our help? I think it's the wrong perspective. I would encourage you to approach this from the perspective, what are all the ways in which we can plug in which we can engage, in which we can stop this cycle from happening again. That's what we're doing in my administration. So I appreciate the acknowledgement that our administration is doing some good work around this. It's because we have said we represent all of our community, and we're going to take every single action we can imagine to ensure safe interactions for both our police officers and for our community members. Our work would be better off. The work in Minneapolis would be better off. The work around our state and country would be better off if our legislature approaches this work from the same perspective. It literally is a matter of urgent life and death for us. So please don't change the subject. Please don't tie it to other things. Please address the matter of life and death that's before us right now. I'll also share with you that the city of Minneapolis faced something that none of us ever have. The number of people who came out into community, the volume of unrest that happened there, the number of fires there, I think is something that none of us are prepared to say, well, this should have been done differently, or that should have been done differently, or that should have been done differently. I certainly am not. And so I would encourage all of us as we try to judge what happened in our communities. I would say, one, Mayor Fry is a close friend of mine. We talk literally every single day. And if what you're saying is we regret and lament what happened in our cities during that time, I think you'd have unanimous agreement. But I would encourage you, if you have criticism to bring, to pair that with any specific recommendations that you have on how we could have done a better job of balancing not just our desire for property safety, but our desire for the safety, our passion for the safety of our officers, for the safety of our community members, for the safety of those demonstrators, and for the safety of, and for the sanctity of human life in our community. That's the dichotomy. That's the paradox. That's the challenge that we're engaging in this. And for those of us who are committed to never seeing that happen again, I would encourage us all to not just focus on the how people protested and how people responded after the protests, after the killing, but to respond to the why. Why are people protesting in the first place? American history has shown time and time again that when we approach protests with just a desire to stifle and change the how, but don't affect the why, those voices of protest, that unrest only grows and grows. We are trying to prevent that in Minnesota. And the only way, please mark my words, is to address the underlying causes which cause us to be here over and over and over again, which caused the rest of the world to look at Minnesota for answers and look at Minnesota for leadership, which I think is the right place for them to look, because I believe in us. I believe in you. I believe in the power of our state capitol and legislature to change this. And our job, fundamentally speaking, is to do everything that we can, every single thing that we can, to ensure that our children don't have to face this cycle over and over and over again in the way that we do. So I apologize for taking too much time, but I feel emotional about the suggestion that the legislature should do the bare minimum that you can do and allow other cities to do all the things that they can do without your help. I think the people in Minnesota and the people across this planet are literally looking at us right now to do everything we can do. I apologize, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mayor, no need to apologize. We're all in the moment where we're supposed to be, and you're in this moment with us right now. And I appreciate your counsel, your wise counsel, as well as a humanity-centered advice that you're offering in a heartfelt and genuine way. So thank you for your guidance. Members, that seems like a good place for us to adjourn this meeting. There will be a town hall meeting later today out in Maple Grove. Please visit our website. For that, it is going to be outside. It's going to be hot and muggy. We're providing lots of water for those who come. Hopefully we'll have a good community-centered discussion as folks in that community invited us out to continue this conversation. And hopefully
Chair Mariani.
Continue to have all across the state. And so, members, with that, this committee stands adjourned.